The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this one I'm excited about. I am here at Stratus Winery in Niagara-on-the-Lake. It is absolutely gorgeous, place I've come to many, many times in the past. And I've always wanted to interview my next guest, who I got to meet at Grapes for Humanity charity event. And then immediately I glommed on to him and I said, I need you to do the podcast. And he's been kind enough to do it. It is the head winemaker, J.L. Grew. J.L., thank you so much for being on the pod.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
First, for people who don't know, and I didn't even know this, what does J.L. stand for?
Well, J.L. stands for a very long name called Jean Laurent that in the Anglo-Saxon world doesn't fit anymore, so I shortened it out to J.L., and that seems to work.
Let's start with just your past. Your early days of coming to Niagara, Niagara-on-the-Lake, it was around 1981, correct?
Well, in 1988, I came here, but that was more like a cellarat. I was between travelings around the world, and it was nice to have a pause through harvest. So I did that for a year, 2 years. And then I came here for good, knowing what I was getting into.
And what were you getting into?
Pleasure, but more importantly, the freedom of creation, openness from the consumers to new ideas and new ways of doing things. A vineyard that was very promising, you could see it was moving very fast. It was evolving out of, North American varieties into viniferas, European varieties. So it was a really a great time, where all the big wineries were closing down because of new free trade, supposedly. There was a nursery of small vineyard and winery starting from scratch. And that was a very exciting time. Coming from a guy that's coming from Europe, is great, very traditional, has fantastic wines, but evolving is slower, moving on is slower. So you really need to, I really felt I needed some freedom. And coming here in Canada has been a great move in the last 35 years now.
We'll get to freedom in a second, because I love this quote you talked about if Bordeaux tried to grow Pinot Noir, it would be a crime against humanity.
That's right.
I laughed when I read that. We'll get there. But I just want to make sure I got the timeline. So you're coming here. What brought you here as a cellar rat in the late 80s? Obviously, it was freedom, but I was wondering where the wineries you went to before you and Stratus became a partnership.
Oh, yes. I started when I arrived here in Canada. I worked for a company called Hillebrand, which was very innovative at the time. That's called now Trius, because we created back then with my predecessor colleagues, Ben Hutchin, we created a wine called Trius. And that was a bit of a daring idea because everybody was moving into, we don't want to hear about Chablis and Burgundy. We want to hear about real variety like Chardonnay, Cab Sauvignon. So that was the taste. And then we call a wine Trius Red. That was like a anti-marketing. But it turns out to become a cult wine over the years to the point that the winery changed its name to Trius.
And then from Trius, how did you make your way to Stratus?
Well, there was this very exciting new project at Stratus where everything was focused in high quality, from the vineyard, more importantly, to the winery. So I really helped building this winery in a way that was very unusual, where you could say, oh, it's very innovative, but really it was very traditional. Once people had no pumps. So we have this winery is not using any pump. Everything was meant for towards the grapes. So the machinery goes to where the grapes are. There is no area, no processing area where all the grapes and wine have to go to. So everything was built that way. So it takes a bit of a conception to do that because it was new. Engineers had some hard time with that idea because engineers are used to, you want to go from A to B, you just put a pump and keep moving.
Right.
And we wanted no pump. We wanted to work with gravity going from the top of the winery all the way down. So anyway, that's a few examples of that. And of course, David Feldberg, being the owner of the winery, was very environmental conscious. So that's part of it. That's why the winery is all working with geothermy and so on and so forth.
Going back to your youth, you worked in Burgundy and in Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. For people that know those regions and know the wines, What are some of the major differences? I mean, beyond the grapes, obviously, right, and the, you know, blending in Bordeaux and none of that in Burgundy, but just what are some of the biggest differences in making wines in these two iconic wine regions?
Well, you point out the variety is extremely differently, but the climate is extremely different as well. So that all of that between the terroir, which is very different as well, the climate and the different grape varieties, you end up making a different winemaking, a different viticulture, and it was great for me to be able to learn both ways. It looks like a treason by then. You know, when I left Burgundy to go to Bordeaux, people look at me like, oh, this is treason. And then I left Bordeaux to come to Canada. That was another treason. But at the end of the day, I did learn a lot through all this process. And when I came to Canada, I was not all knowledgeable, all these things, not because I spent university's time that I knew everything about Canada. I had to learn a lot of things here because the climate, the soil, the varieties are different again. So you adapt to where you live. You don't impose your techniques and your ideas.
What is winemaking like here in Niagara versus the old world? I know that in terms of temperature, like what is the main similarity and the main difference, or one or two, between doing it here versus there?
Similarities, you would say varieties. I know they are European varieties. Winemakers are very often from Europe. Many of them now are being trained here, but originally that was the case. And the big difference is definitely that here you can plant Gewürztraminer Tabernet beside Cab Sauvignon and nobody get offended. And consumers are much more open-minded to new ideas and wine. So, you know, it's not like, oh, you can't do that because it's been done 200 years, but, oh yeah, we'll try your wine. If we like it, we'll buy it again. Otherwise, forget it.
Yeah. How great was that for you just from a creative standpoint? And again, it's obviously an honor to be making wines in Bordeaux and Burgundy, but just coming here where there aren't as many laws or strict policies when it comes to what you're making.
Right. Definitely that freedom of creativity is very important to me. I am a guy that loves research and development, and I've always been making research and development, and that's the gateway to innovation and to great wines. So that's allowed. Many of the things I created here, if I would have done that in Europe, I would be the black sheep of the region, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's, as I say, plus the welcoming of consumers and peers saying, yeah, sure, try it. Sometimes you hear critics, you know. The first time I picked some grapes in November, people thought that was nuts. First time I planted Sangiovese, people think, you can't plant Sangiovese, it's an Italian variety in Canada. No worry, we're at the same latitude anyway. So it's all trying to break some barriers carefully, because, you know, it's you don't want to make bad wines at the end of the day. But at the end of the day, creating these new wines, these new ideas, without the carcan of legislation. We have a legislation which is to protect the consumer here, but not so much about, oh, what's traditional, what we've been doing for 200 years. So it's a very different approach.
Yeah, versus if, as you said, if you try to plant Pinot in Margaux, everyone would go crazy, wouldn't they?
That's right.
Yeah.
Though, if you look at history, in the 19th century, there was some Pinot Noir in Bordeaux area, but now that has been totally expelled.
Yeah.
Like Gamay in Burgundy, where there was plenty of Gamay in Burgundy that was making excellent wine back then. But people get in this very traditional way and they think that's it.
I want to get in a second to all things Stratus and what the philosophy here, and talk to you obviously about blending. But I just want to go back to when you were a kid and the impact, you know, you talk about growing up in Loire and your father, and what impact did he have on you, on us sitting here right now?
Well, the major, my parents were not growers, but they were wine lovers. So every year we would migrate to the different part of France with a big trailer, and we would buy wines a bit everywhere to share with some friend. We would bottle it ourselves and enjoy it for years to come. So I think that's where my passion for it comes from.
And did you choose a barrel? Like, I'm wondering, how did that work, just buying wines back then?
Yeah, in fact, yeah. Sometimes we would choose a barrel. You know, we would taste many barrels and say to the guy, okay, we'd like to buy that one and negotiate for the price, whatever, and then get that into our trailer and go home. You know, sometimes we would bottle on site, rarely. Yeah. Most of the time we would bottle at home.
That'd be great. That must have been so much fun for you as a young man.
Great learning experience.
Yeah.
Another thing that convinced me about winemaking is that when I was studying in agriculture, in the agriculture world, I realized that winemaking agriculture or viticulture is one of the rare things where people appreciate quality versus quantity. You know, if you grow potatoes or tomatoes, potatoes, a bit less now, but back then it was nobody cared about. The price was the thing. Mm-hmm. Where that's the only product in agriculture where people are ready to pay a higher price for quality. It's very unique.
Yeah, it is. It's very different what you guys are growing here versus, as you say, potatoes back in the day. So Stratus opened to the public in 2005?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. What were those first couple of years like?
It was fantastic. People were very enthusiastic. It was a daring project because...
What made it daring?
Well, daring because we were making assemblage. You know, assemblage is something I did learn in Europe. It's a very old traditional way. But North America is not used to that. As I said earlier, we are used to our varietal wine, like Chardonnay and this and that. But by this... By gaining that purity out of Chablis and Champagne that were none, we lost this grand art of assemblage, which is very typical European, and more importantly, very typical in cool climate. It's a great way to maintain consistency from year to year by using different varieties, and not all varieties are doing well every year. Climate changes. And therefore, by adapting to that, you make a great wine every year, more consistent than you would have to make a varietal wine.
And how much does that like help protect you? Like I imagine in some areas, I was talking with the people from Molly Duker from Australia, and,
right.
they say honestly, like because of the heat and not a lot of disease, it's much easier to make wine there. But here, you have so many different things, like as you mentioned, the cold and a flash freeze. How much does blending help protect you against those very difficult vintages?
Well, when we have a weakness in such a variety, or not none of that variety, we have all these other varieties that normally are not participating in the assemblage that save the day. For example, when it's not a Cabernet Sauvignon Cap Franc year, once in a while that happens, it's a cooler year, and they are late varieties, so therefore the earlier varieties, such as Syrah, such as Gamay, lately, even Tempranillo makes it save the day, or Tanat. So that flexibility helps us making great wine year after year.
Tempranillo, that you must have got some people looking at you funny when you're planting. You mentioned Sangiovese, but yeah. I imagine Sangiovese and Tempranillo, but a lot of people are wondering, what are you doing?
Yes, absolutely, of course. When you are pioneer in anything, people always laugh at you or say yeah. You are crazy. And then, you know, we have been... having these varieties planted since 2006, we make wine every year with them, and we are very happy of the result. We have a misconception, typical Canadian, of, oh, our climate is too cold.
Right, yeah.
Sure,
yeah,
it is in winter, but in summer, it's very warm. Our latitude is the latitude of Nice, north of Tuscan, you know, south of Bordeaux. So we have abilities to grow grapes and to make great wines, much better than people would think. And at the beginning, when I arrived here 35 years ago, they, oh, you can grow Riesling, okay, but that's it. Well, in fact, now we know we can make great red wine, full body red wine that can age 30 years or more.
Where we're sitting in the Niagara on the Lake area, and you guys are Cabernet, Cap Franc, Merlot,
yes.
Syrah, like, you know, a lot of the big Bordeaux blends. What is it about this specific area in terms of temperature that works for the vision that you guys want to do?
Well, the particular vineyard around the Stratus Winery, it's all around, and it's a warm area. I would not say it's a great area to grow Pinot Noir or Riesling, for example. Mm-hmm. There are great areas for that in other part of the peninsula. But because it's so warm and it has such long, warm fall, that allows us to keep ripening things all the way to the end of November, if needed, to be able to get our red varieties full body, no green, nice black fruits, and so on and so forth.
If someone gets your latest release of the Stratus Red,
yes,
I think it's 2021 or 22. I'm trying to
remember. Yeah, well, now we are selling the 21, but
yeah.
Soon we'll sell 22. And
right.
Then we are working now with Dean, the winemaker here. We are working into making the 23.
Mm-hmm.
And we know it's going to be 2% of Tempranillo in that one,
oh,
surprisingly
okay.
enough. But at the end of the day, it's an ongoing work. I am a founding winemaker, so that's my title. Dean is more the winemaker because
right.
I'm kind of semi-retired after all these years. After 45 harvests, I feel I deserve a bit of time for myself.
I would say that is absolutely a very fair statement. What should people expect? Like when they get a bottle of Stratus Red, and obviously every year is going to be different because different vintages, but they get the 21 Stratus Red.
Yes.
What should they expect from this wine?
Well, they should expect a complex wine. Intense in the nose, a wine that has full mouthfeel but refreshing acidity in the finish, and a longevity of more than 10 years guaranteed.
The process of blending, How early in the growing season are you already thinking about it? About, okay, there's our Merlot, there's our Cab Franc, there, you know, there's all the different plots. How early in your mind are you thinking what your percentages are going
to
be?
Well, the main thing is not to think, because it's to make sure you have the best varieties, the best, you know, the vineyards making your wine. So you have to be patient to be, before you pick, and keep everything separate. You know, we have 16 different varieties, 45 different blocks in our vineyard. It's very diversified. So it's diversity for complexity. And at the end of the day, we need to make sure that's represented in the wines.
I love this quote. I pick them late because I'm a lazy winemaker and I want nature to do the job for me. And nature does a wonderful job. I was wondering, Jill, if you could expand on that quote.
I really believe in that. It sounds funny, but it's really true. You don't make great wines in the winery. You can only get the grapes to the right spot in the bottle without damage. But you make the wine, the aromatics, and all of these things that we enjoy in wine, this is made in the vineyard, definitely. And if you pick your grapes too early because you're afraid of the rain, afraid of something, because you want them in so you don't have to worry about it, you lose opportunities to make better wines. It is true that the winery, as fancy as it is, Stratus is seen as a very innovative winery. Our most precious asset here is the vineyard.
Have there ever been years where you've been nervous? We're like, I've left the grapes and I think I might have been leaving them on too long.
Very rarely. Because we have a great thing here. If I was in Bordeaux and Napa or Napa, I would be much more nervous. Because at some point, here it's too cold for, let's say, rot to grow, but it's warm enough to keep ripening.
Right.
So that's happened towards the end of October. We can keep going all along November and not having any trouble. I do that in Bordeaux. More likely, I'm going to lose my grapes, so I would have to pick it before that happens. Here, we have no worry. It can snow, it can rain. We don't make a big wind. We don't mind that. We know now we are in November. We can be patient and nothing wrong will happen.
Did you say November?
Yes.
When, like last year, for instance,
yes.
What was your picking schedule?
Well,
do you remember? Like what's the latest you guys pick?
Well, the latest is December, in fact. I'm not talking ice wine here. I'm talking regular wine.
Really? You're picking grapes in December?
Yeah, and they are making much better wines than the one I would have picked in November.
Wow.
And this is exactly what you discover over time. First, you say, oh, we have a bad climate, it's too cold here, blah, blah, blah. But you discover, no. We have a great advantage over other people, maybe, is because it's cold enough to be able to avoid fungus, but it's warm enough to be able to keep ripening. And we do mat control every week, and we know what's happening.
Right.
We know we can see the evolution, the positive evolution of the grapes.
I imagine when you started picking so much later, I imagine some other neighboring wineries or winemakers, they must have thought you guys were crazy.
Yeah, but we're used to that by now. That when you are innovative and you have new ideas, people always start with that.
Yeah.
But now it's a common place to pick in November in the Niagara Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
Some years are warm, like last year. So we finished mid-November, and many people finish in October. But when it's a more difficult year, a cooler year, you really have to be patient, and it pays.
What is the process when you're deciding the blend, the final percentage? Is it you and a bunch of other people? Is it mostly you on your own? I'm always curious about the work that goes into nailing the final blend.
Well, the first thing is not to think too much, okay?
If
you take all your best wine in the winery, you'll never make the best wine with putting them together. So we do blind tastings with, you know, Dean Stoica, the winemaker of Stratus, and the team, the production team, and eventually we widen the team and get the marketing people, even consultants, to taste. And never let a winemaker decide what wines to make by himself. Mm-hmm. So we start by ourselves, right, to get all the legwork out. But it's hundreds of tastings you have to go through, you know,
mm-hmm.
over a period of 2 months before you find out what is the best wine. And by tasting, blind tasting is important. Otherwise, you have preconceived idea that not necessarily the best wine and Cabernet Franc might not be the best assemblage. So it's only by tasting, understanding the synergies between the different lots that eventually you make the best wine every year.
I like what you just said there. There's almost checks and balances against you. There cannot be a dictatorship. There can't
absolutely
be one person.
Not. Absolutely not.
I saw this quote about your 2020 Stratus Merlot White Label. You said, we couldn't have made these wines 20 years ago. No one could have. This quality level was unimaginable 20 years ago. which leads to a simple question. When you guys, 20 years ago, it was 2005.
Right.
Why was it so different then, and what's changed over the last two decades to allow this wine?
Well, in general, a bunch of things, of course, as usual, but one of the main ones, the vineyard is aging. So as the vineyard is aging, it's making better wine. The climate is warming up, which is a shame, but for grapes in Niagara Peninsula and these late red varieties, it's a positive as well. And then us winemakers did learn not to be too intrusive, mm-hmm. meaning we are less interventionist than ever. So meaning we're not jumping on the grapes to extract whatever we can. We let things happen by themselves in the tanks. And again, back to nature does the job. So what do you need to do a lot of work on your grapes? Just let them happen and turn them into a bottle.
So really it's everything's getting a little bit warmer and everyone's getting a little bit smarter. Yes. And the vines are getting older.
Exactly.
So it's one of the things you couldn't have accelerated anyway in 2005. There's no way you can make the wines now back in 2005. It was just really a waiting game.
Exactly. Absolutely.
That's fascinating.
When 1991 was a great year, imagine. Mm-hmm. So we knew something coming from Bordeaux with my colleague about how to make great red wine. But we were still very surprised that suddenly, wow, we can make great wines. But the vineyard had already evolved back then. And back then we said, oh, you know, that wine can age 5 years, you know. Well, now we have bottles of it. 30 years later, that's still enjoyable.
That is one of the marks of making great wine, is that 20, 25 years later, the fruit is there and the wine's still evolving, isn't it?
Exactly. And yeah. We didn't know that back then. As regular Canadian, we thought, can't make that, can't do that. But yes, time proved that we can.
How surprised would 2005 version of you be if you could have gone into the future and seen and tasted the wines now? Because you said you couldn't have predicted. What were your expectations in 05 versus what they are now?
I had a vision back then already, okay? Yeah. I knew the climate was warming up. I had seen that already. I knew our vineyard had to be worked on, rebalanced, rechecked, and we've been working at it for the last 25 years because really we started this vineyard in 2020, even if we opened the doors 20 years ago in 2025. I had a vision of it. It was a question of rebalancing the vineyard, let the things happening, replanting. You know, we had done quite a bit of replanting. I knew these young vines would get better. Now everything is more than 20 years old. So it's that I knew would happen, but it takes time. Anything in winemaking takes time.
Do any of your old colleagues, friends who maybe haven't left France or Bordeaux and Burgundy, do you ever surprise them with your wines? Are they ever shocked because maybe just they don't understand what can be done here in Niagara?
Of course, and I like to do it, especially with people of the same. If I bring my Bordeaux assemblage in Bordeaux, you know, or even the white Stradus assemblage, you don't tell them what's in there, otherwise they'll jump around. Mm-hmm. But then they enjoy the wine. Oh, this is very interesting. And then you tell them, oh, there is a Sémillon in there, and Sauvignon Blanc, and Chardonnay. Oh, my goodness, how you do that? But it's because ice wine is another typical one that people always enjoy. But it's not ice wine only. It's about red wine. It's about our assemblage of whites.
You must enjoy when they get surprised when they find out, when you reveal the bottle, that it's not from Saint-Emilion, but it's from here.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. We have that over and over, and it's becoming a way of life of doing that nowadays because people know that. But, you know, winemakers now in France know Canadian vineyard exists. Mm-hmm. Like general public in France, no. But winemakers at least do. And they already did appreciate many of our wines there and there, even if it's not widely available in Europe. It is appreciated.
That is true, but not available. Every time I go to Europe, I always go into every wine store and or restaurants and looking at the list. Right. I'm always curious. Do you got anything? And usually it's some old ice wine. That's why I've been sitting there forever.
Yeah. Our wines are in the UK, in Belgium. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we are locked in Canada only, but true. The majority of our sales are here in Ontario, in Canada, some in the US, some in Japan. But, you know, we have a market to conquest. We have to get 100% Ontario wine drinking by people here. Mm-hmm. You know, at this point, 60% are imported. So if you look at France, you look at, you know, what's going on in Europe, we have a market to conquest.
Yes.
Anyway, whatever. Sorry about that.
It's a theme on this podcast for years when I started to focus more on Niagara and Prince Edward Hubbard County is just the locals drinking the local wine. And
right.
I do wonder, it's funny, I was talking about this with the owners of Leaning Post,
right,
about how the tariffs and Trump has created a higher level of wine nationalism in Ontario, where more people from here are drinking wine from here.
I wish so, because we have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
People are still drinking wines from all over the world, and the LCBO is promoting that in a grand way. So we would really appreciate that people give us a chance, taste our wines, and enjoy what we are currently making. There is a say that in the 70s, wine were not so great in Canada. That's true, mm-hmm. but that's the 70s. You know, we're talking 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have been moving on since then, big time.
It's always hard to break that out of people.
Right.
What do people need to know? Just a couple things about your whites. I mean, you know, I've been focusing a lot on the reds, but on your Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, Chardonnay, and things like that.
Well, we have to make sure in this warming up climate, we have to make sure they are still very fresh. And that's a challenge. So that's why these ones, we don't pick them later, we pick them earlier. Because sometimes I'm the guy picking the earliest of the bunch around here, because I really want to preserve acidity and good fresh aromatics in our Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay. We're not trying to make Burgundy, we're not trying to make Napa Valley, we're trying to make Stratus and Niagara Chardonnay or wines in general. So
I guess, yeah, that's interesting. You'd be picking your whites later up in the bench area, but because, as you mentioned, the warmth here, you would have to pick earlier because,
as you
said, the acidity.
And we do that. No worry. It's easier to pick early than pick late.
How many vintages have you done?
I think 45.
45.
I think it's counting up every year, right?
Yeah,
so last time I counted was 45.
I asked that, is there one year that stands out, the hardest year for you?
Stand out at hardest, two different things, but I would say 1991.
Yeah.
Because I was a young winemaker, my colleague was homesick, so he came back to France. We had studied together in Bordeaux. And I was in charge of the entire production here after only being here 2 years. And that was a scary year. At the same time, it was a great year. So it was really interesting and challenging and scary as the life of a winemaker through that harvest.
So 91 was the one that stands out.
That's right.
Yeah. What does this mean for you? I saw that back in 2023, you were honored with the Carl Kaiser Winemaker Award at the Canadian Wine Industry Awards. I'm wondering, what did that mean for you professionally and personally?
Well, it is great to be recognized by your peers, for sure, you know, because you are working, you're on the grinding mill, your shoes are rooted in the vineyard, and so it's nice to understand that the world somewhat appreciate what you are doing over time. So it's really welcome. It's always great to be honored that way. It's very welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that to any of my colleagues.
If someone is doing a blind tasting, and I know there's generalizations we always have to be nervous about, but I'm wondering what for you would say are the main differences between your Syrah,
right,
and say Northern Rhone. Like, I'm just trying to think of the famous Syrah areas,
right,
on Earth, and, you know, maybe other people would pick, you know, Australia,
right,
but
yeah.
I just wonder what are some of the stylistic differences.
Yeah, not a chance we do Australian Shiraz.
No, we are
cool climate, so certainly more our France is the Rhone Valley, but we're not trying to make Rhone Valley. We are trying to make Niagara Syrah,
mm-hmm.
And over the 20-30 years of making Syrah, we know how to treat it here to make the right Syrah. And I'm sure if I was in the Rhone Valley, I would treat it totally differently.
Of course.
So it's really about making the best wine of Niagara. And sure, we have inspiration, we taste wine from all over the world, but we're not trying to copycat. We are good enough to know that we can make excellent Niagara Syrah.
I won't say, do you have a favorite varietal? Because I'm sure it changes all the time. It's like no one can pick their favorite child. You know what? I'll ask it this way. What is the easiest grape for you to grow, and which is the one that's the biggest pain in the ass?
Okay, the easiest one is Cabernet Franc. You know, I'm from the Loire Valley. I love Cab Franc. It's well adapted here. We have a warmer climate than the Loire Valley to start with, and we are much lower in latitude. So Cab Franc is a pleasure to grow. Even we have 16 varieties, one-third of our vineyard. Cabernet Franc is definitely the future of this region in red wine, as well as Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Riesling, but definitely Cab Franc is there. The most painful is maybe, we discussed that, Syrah,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't like our winter. So it's very winter sensitive. And Syrah is like cherries. If you have it super ripe, wonderful, and it starts raining, in October, whoop, it starts to blow up like a cherry. So that's a bit painful, but nevertheless, we're still planting Syrah because we believe it can make great wines. So we go over the pains, but and still make Syrah.
How much longer do you think you want to do this? You're now, you know, not the head winemaker, but you're still such an important part in the decision making and everything that goes on to making the wines of Stratus. Do you see a day where you're like, you know what, I can retire?
I don't know. I enjoy it. It's a passion in life. Yeah. You know, I see many people retiring because they are sick of their job and so on. There's a lot of people around me. I don't feel like that at all.
Right.
So I am happy. I'm not the main winemaker anymore, but I'm very happy to contribute through tastings and, you know, through ideas. I travel all over the world because I have time. I'm spy number one. All over the world, I'm spying what people do, but really I'm enjoying visiting vineyards, meeting winemakers, get inspired by many other ideas. And not, again, we're not copying, but we get inspired by new ideas, new ways. So I bring that back to Stratus after my travels, and I hope that's useful too.
Is there any recent one that sticks out for you, some inspirations from some wine region in the world? Like, oh, that's interesting. That I could see how there's lessons there that we could use here.
You learn everywhere. But one very eye-opening one was traveling in Georgia and Armenia. You know, at Stratus, we have quite a bit of amphoras now. We are growing in amphoras, clay containers. And these people have been doing it for 8,000 years. So it's nice to see how they do it, what they have been doing, and to see how the culture of wine is so important there. You think France is a wine, it is the wine country. Forget that. Georgia is. You have a master of wine ceremony when you start a meal. You never have wine without food. It's very, very traditional and ingrained. Even after 50 years of communism, they are still at it big time. So it was very eye-opening and very interesting, both the culture and the technical part of it.
Last question for you. I imagine you're still having a ton of fun. Every day, it's like a puzzle to solve. And whatever is, like, it's a sunny day today, which means something. It was raining a ton last week, and then blending and everything else that goes into it, and what's going on with your Sangiovese or Tenant. Like, I imagine every day still fills you with a real sort of creative boost.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It is a passion. So a passion you can get away just like that and drop it just out of nowhere. So it's still a pleasure. No, I do not have the entire winery on my shoulders now. Dean does that. Mm-hmm. And I kept maybe the pleasure of my job, which is the tasting, the assemblage, maybe a bit of influencers, and it is maybe the quintessence of what I've been trying to do all these 45 years. When I was a young winemaker, I thought, well, winemaking is only harvest. After that, you go on vacation for 6 months. Never work. I finally make it happen now. So it's a real pleasure.
During the heart of it, yeah, there's no way you were off for 6 months, you know, when you were starting Stratus.
No. That doesn't work. You no. can't be a winemaker and go away for 6 months.
Good Lord, no. JL, really appreciate doing this. You know, there's so many people that admire Stratus and the boldness of it, the consistent quality. This is a beautiful place. It's one of the gems of Niagara-on-the-Lake. Anyone listening to this, if you are traveling to Niagara, you need to come to Stratus. I've been here so many times. I always admire the wines, and I love your story, and congratulations. And thank you so much for doing the podcast today.
Thank you to you, and you're welcome to come back anytime you want. You'll always be welcome.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.